A couple of days ago, a young woman confided in me that her father had been diagnosed with a serious cancer. And she was terrified about what might happen to him, and she was struggling to cope. And then she began telling me what a wonderful man he was. And in particular, he always went out of his way to do good things for people. She said, "Why do things like cancer happen to good people like my dad? Why do so many evil people live long, happy lives and people like my dad die young? Why?" Nearly everyone has struggled with that question or a variation on it at some point. More often than not, even if it's not spoken out loud, there's a God question behind it. If there is a God of love and justice in charge, how come life is so unfair? If God cares about goodness and fairness, why would God not make sure that everyone gets what they deserve in this world? Why? Tonight's first Bible reading came from the book of Job. And the book of Job is all about this question. But, spoiler alert, doesn't neatly solve it. We've had readings from the book of Job for the last 4 weeks. And you may have noticed that the first and last ones had a very different flavour from the two in the middle. The book of Job is a bit like a sandwich. If you just read the first and last chapters on their own, it reads like a neat little short story. It begins with a conversation between God and the Satan about a good man called Job. And the Satan accuses Job of only being loyal to God because he's so blessed. And then with God's permission, the Satan destroys Job's family, his possessions, and his health. Job is devastated, but he continues to honour God. And eventually, in the part that we heard tonight, God rewards him by blessing the remainder of his life even more richly than the first part. Now, if that was all there was to the book of Job, its message would be clear and simple. Not necessarily satisfying, but clear and simple. The normal pattern of the world is that everybody gets what they deserve, but sometimes God allows good people to suffer as a test. And if they pass the test, they will be richly rewarded again and live happily ever after. But that's not all there is to the book of Job. Another 40 chapters have been sandwiched in between the opening scene and the happy ever after. And the book now presents a much more complex picture. Its answers are not so simple. They may not even finally be answers. In the 40 chapters in the middle, Job argues with God and with four of his friends about the injustice of what is happening to him. And while he may not curse God, as the Satan had predicted, he certainly accuses God of treating him with undeserved cruelty and of failing to govern the world with justice. Now, it's a strange sandwich because the style of the filling, the 40 chapters in the middle, is very different from the two ends. It's so different that it's easy to imagine that some editor has taken two different stories and sandwiched one into the other. But whether or not that's true, we now read them together. And much of the meaning now comes from the tension created by the sandwiching. Interestingly, if I might digress for a moment, we actually got the back end of a similar sandwich in tonight's gospel reading. Mark, the gospel writer Mark, is the master sandwich maker among the biblical authors. He creates little sandwich stories all the time, but he also uses a kind of giant club sandwich as the structure in the middle of the gospel. There's some teaching about faithfulness and inclusiveness, which is sandwiched in between two stories about welcoming small children, which in turn is sandwiched between two stories about the disciples arguing over greatness, sandwiched in turn between two stories about the healing of blind men, the second of which we heard tonight. And the overall effect is that all the material that is framed between the two healing stories comes to illustrate Jesus' attempt to open the eyes of his disciples. Mark makes quite a lot of use of an image from the prophet Isaiah about God's people having eyes that can't see and ears that can't hear. So Jesus tries hard to open our eyes so that we might see the world through the loving eyes of God, but turns out that healing the literally blind proves easier. So blind Bartimaeus at the end of the sandwich, with his eyes opened, follows Jesus on the way, a picture of what Jesus hopes for all of us. So to segue back to Job, perhaps this sandwich framework in the book of Job is similarly trying to open our eyes to enlighten us in a place where it often seems there is only darkness amidst the suffering of the world. Well, perhaps, but it's certainly not as simple or clear-cut as in Mark. At first glance, there is a similarity because both sandwiches end with a kind of happy ever-after picture. Job restored to health and wealth, and Bartimaeus healed and joyously following Jesus. But the happy ever-after picture in Job is different. It somehow disturbs us. And I think the author or editor probably intended it to. Somehow it's way too happy ever after. It feels exaggerated, unrealistic. And it feels way too neat and simple. Anybody who has lived a bit of life or even just read the 40 chapters in the middle, knows that even if this story really did end up in an enormous happy ever after, that's the exception, not the rule. Life does not consistently work out that way. And the anguished questions of the 40 chapters are neither answered nor swept aside by this one oh-so-happy ending. Anyone who has ever lost a loved one knows that even if Job's children do grow up to be the most wonderful young men and the most beautiful young women in all the land, as the story describes, that can never answer Job's aching cry for his previous children who died tragically and unfairly. If anything, the author seems to amplify these nagging questions of the happy ending. Like, it says that God pays back Job double for everything that he lost, even to the point of giving him double the normal 70 lifespan. But paying back double is what the biblical law prescribes as the restitution that a criminal must pay to his victim. That's not letting God off the hook. And despite a final speech in which God says that Job's friends were wrong, was it not one of Job's friends who had said that if Job admitted his sin and repented, God would doubly bless the remainder of his life? The author seems to be planting explosives into this happy ending. The same final speech had God saying that Job had spoken rightly. But in the sandwich filling, Job has repeatedly accused God of being callous and cruel and of failing to govern the world with justice. More explosives? This apparently happy ending is starting to look subversive and disturbing. Perhaps it is a deliberate irony, obviously too simple and too happy, because it's actually wanting to provoke us into protesting. Perhaps it's trying to stir us up to reject this simplistic closure and inviting us to keep asking the hard questions and refusing to let anyone fob them off with cheap promises of happy endings and neat answers. It confronts us with some of our own over-simple expectations. It pricks at our desire for neat answers, for a comprehensive explanation that makes sense of everything. It shines a light on our desire for a religion that will have an answer for everything and so relieve us of having to live with uncertainties and unanswered questions. It exposes our attraction to easy answer theologies and our almost fatal desire to ignore the persistent failure of those kind of systems. It's rightly said that to every complex problem there is a simple answer, and it's wrong. It's not that the book of Job offers no answers. It's that it doesn't offer one all-conclusive answer. It doesn't resolve all our questions, especially our theoretical questions about how to make sense of it all in a neat system. Instead, it offers us multiple answers that don't quite hold together. The simple framing story first offers one kind of answer. The voice of Job and the voices of his friends in the sandwich filling offer two more perspectives, two more kinds of answers. The voice of God speaking from a whirlwind in the later chapters offers another kind of answer. And just when we think that it is all building to a satisfying resolution, the final chapter returns to an obviously oversimple story full of obvious landmines to frustrate us. It's actually easy to feel angry at the book at the end, because it seems to promise serious answers and then it delivers multiple answers that seem to contradict each other. In the 40 chapters, it makes us work really hard at unravelling complex ethical dilemmas. And then when we expect to be rewarded for our efforts, it skips off into the distance without rewarding us with any kind of resolution. It's easy to feel angry with it. And perhaps you'll go home angry with your sermon for exactly the same reason. And perhaps a lot of people felt angry with Jesus when he answered serious questions with parables that similarly teased and challenged and shed new light on the question, but refused to zoom in on one clear-cut definitive answer. Perhaps in the end, that's the invitation. The invitation of the book of Job and of Jesus himself. We are being invited into a deep and wondrous life that is rich in relationships and complexities. We're being invited into a life where the search for answers and the search for meaning are always communal activities. There is always a community dialogue. Each one brings a different perspective, and no one has all the answers, but we are closer to the answers and richer if we properly hear from one another. And sure, sometimes that will feel frustrating and unsatisfying, but consider the alternative for a moment. Has there ever been a system of clear-cut, one-size-fits-all answers that didn't end up becoming a repressive totalitarian nightmare? Churches that insist on one definite answer for everything end up as abusive cults that demand unquestioning conformity. Doubts and genuine questions are mercilessly crushed, And those who cannot submit to the approved answers are expelled and demonized. But Jesus, the parable teller, and Job, the relentless questioner, invite us to come with them into a courageous community that welcomes the faith-filled and the doubt-filled equally. It welcomes those who believe easily and those who, because of horrific abuse or trauma, cannot believe anymore. It welcomes those with this answer and those with that answer and those with no answer and those with only more agonizing questions. And it asks us to all respect one another and listen to one another and love one another and continue the journey into life and truth and hope together. Together too with Bartimaeus. We follow the parable teller on the way which leads to another monstrous injustice, a suffering death on the cross. And while the resurrection is a happy ever after to end all happy ever afters, the risen Christ still has fatal wounds. And his cry of, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" still hangs in the air with no clear-cut answer. And my friend's question about her father remains unanswered too. But I reckon that given the choice between a perfect explanation and a community that would surround her and her father with love and care as they face the journey ahead, I think she'd choose the second. But answers or no answers, no one needs to forgo the questions. The wounded hands of the risen one beckon us forward, neither answering all our questions nor condemning our questions and asking us to turn our backs on them, but inviting us to bring those questions with us as we join in the dance of life that is the culture of God, where the final word is not an iron-fisted answer, but an all-inclusive love and mercy and hope.